Okay, we got some stories today I want to share with you. I'm reading a book called The World is Full of Stories, or The World is Made of Stories, something like that. It's by David Loy, and it talks about how our life is created by our stories. And sometimes we make up our own stories, which helps define us, but most of the time other people give us our stories, and they define us. And so I guess it's up to us. So a couple weeks ago, I was scheduled to do a wedding and be part of a conference on compassion. And I was going to give the Buddhist perspective on compassion. So I was looking forward to a busy weekend with some trepidation. And on Tuesday of that week, I decided to wash the cat. And the cat's name is Leo. And he's now called Pigpen. And he was really dirty, and I thought, well, you know, I should wash him because he's really dirty. And so Leo bit me in the process of washing him. By no fault of his own, he was just trying to survive in a bathtub filled with water. And so I looked at my hand, and it didn't look that bad at all to me, and I decided to wait a day to see if it would go north or south. Well, a day later, it went south, and my hand started to swell, and pus started to come out. So I said, well, maybe I should call the doctor. So I have health insurance, thankfully, and so I called Kaiser, and I said, you know, I'm not sure what I should do, but a cat bit me, and what would you recommend? And they say, we recommend you come to the emergency room right now. And I said, really? It's a cat bite. They said, no, it's the worst bite you can get. It's worse than human bites and dog bites because it's filled with bacteria and the teeth are like little needles and it goes really deep. And if it gets into your bloodstream or your bones, it can be really a problem to, you know, to fix you. So I went into the emergency ward. You always have to write out a check before they look at you, you know. So I wrote out my check, and I got a half hour of IV of antibiotics and a tetanus shot. And then they made an appointment for me the next day, which turned out to be Friday, to see the orthopedic surgeon. So I go back the next day to see the orthopedic surgeon, and there I am sitting in the waiting room, and people have walkers and crutches and casts, and I have my little finger like this. And so I walk in, and I said, you know, I'm really sorry to bother you. I just have a cat bite, and he just freaked out. He said, cat bite? And he said, oh, no. He said, you got to go to the hospital right now. I said, really? I said, you know, I've got a busy weekend. I'm going to do a wedding, and I'm going to be in a conference. Can I go to the hospital on Monday? And he said, no. He said, even if we wait 8 hours, it could really be a problem. So we want you to go right now. I said, well, I can't go right now, but I'll come back in 2 hours because I got to go call everybody and tell them I can't do anything. I'll be in the hospital. So Friday night, I checked into the hospital, again through the emergency room, and I was scheduled for an operation at 9 o'clock. So I'm in the pre-op room, waiting to see the surgeon who will be opening up my finger. And his initials are E.T. So on my left hand, he did a big E.T., and I'm thinking, does he think that this is comes from another, you know? And he says, no, it's hospital rules. We have to put our initials on the part of the body we're going to operate on. So if we pick the wrong part of the body, they know who did it. So I felt a little more confident that they were going to work on the right or the left hand, which turned out to be the right hand to work on. And then about a half hour before my operation, they came in and said, okay, you need to take off all your clothes. And I said, well, you know, it's the finger. No, we need you to be naked. I said, really? No underwear? No underwear, naked. And here's your little gown, you know. And I realized all my years of meditation really came in useful at this point, because what they were doing is they were stripping me of my identity, of the way I dressed and felt, and even my ID in my back pocket was now being taken away from me. And I was becoming simply a body that needed to be worked on. And maybe not even a name, maybe just a number or the number on the room. Room number 3, would you get him in here? So I've been told, and I tell people who ask me, you know, I said, you know, it's really best not to go under anesthesia, because sometimes things happen to your brain. And so I was going to use that in my defense for just wanting a local anesthetic, you know, just numb my arm and give me a bottle of whiskey and I'll be fine. You know, and so I spoke to the doctor. I said, you know, doctor, I've been meditating for over 30 years now, and I'm really concerned about my consciousness. And so I rather you wouldn't put me under. And the doctor said, well, you have to talk to the anesthesiologist. That's his job. So now I'm being carted up to go to the anesthesiologist. And he's got a whole team of people now who are gonna work on me. And I said to him, you know, and I did it in a friendly way. I didn't want to make any enemies on the way to the operating room. So I was smiling and being jovial and talkative. And I said to them, you know, I've been meditating now for over 30 years. And they just sort of looked at me in a blank way. And I'm really concerned about my consciousness and my clarity. And I was wondering if you could just sort of numb my arm. And the anesthesiologist said, well, we have to talk to the doctor. It's his call. So at this point, I knew I was in trouble. So now they're strapping me on this chrome table with this huge light above me in this very sterile room. And my arm is strapped to this extension, and my finger is protruding. And they put the little plastic mouthpiece over my face. And I'm going, I guess this isn't going to be a local. And I slowly drifted off. And by gosh, I woke up in post-op, you know, and there I was. And it's almost like, what happened? And the nurse comes over and says, how do you feel? I said, oh, fine. I feel fine. A little tired, a little thirsty. When they put you under, they have Benadryl in there. And the idea of having an antihistamine in there is to prevent you from salivating as much and swallowing as much, because you could choke. So I just had this like desert mouth. And the next thing the nurse says to me as she's looking down at me, did you hear about Kobe Bryant? I said, no. He tore his Achilles tendon. Really? And I'm sitting there, you know. And I sort of got the idea they would bring me back to reality, you know, in L.A. This is L.A. reality. And so now I knew that Kobe Bryant had torn his Achilles, and I was really thirsty. And they had to get a room ready for me, because it's busy. This was Friday night, you know. And so the fire department was there a few times, bringing people in, car crashes, gunshots. But the cat bite victim got to the operating room first, because it was most important. So now I go to my room, and I haven't been in a hospital in 40 years, you know. And so I give presentations a couple times a year to chaplains who work in hospitals. I go visit people in hospitals, but I haven't been a patient in a hospital. And I thought, well, you know, even if I can't do anything over the weekend, at least I can rest. Well, that's not the case. You can't rest in the hospital. They keep you working. From the moment they get you until the moment they get rid of you, you have stuff to do. And you have a whole team of people assigned to you to get you well. And this is your team. And they expect you, number one, to follow orders. And far be it from me, I'm going, what do I need to do now? Well, you need to give us some blood, and we need to take your heart rate. Oh, you're a little stressed, I can tell. You're a little high blood pressure. That's Kobe Bryant, I said. I'm just really bummed, you know. And then they started the IV. So IV, antibiotics, every 6 hours. And it took an hour to drain into my body. So I had this thing in my vein for 2.5 days that they just kept putting antibiotics into me. And at some point, I felt I had no bacteria left at all. I was never going to get a cold or flu again in my entire life because I am now just a walking antibiotics. And all night and all day, it was wake up, do this, do that. It's hard to get comfortable. At one point, the little thing came out and I started to bleed all over the place. And I said, I think something's wrong here. You know, blood is pooling on my side. And they said, oh, it just fell out. And they put it back in. And I'm just thinking to myself, wow, you know, this is just such a trip. You get no rest. Your whole job while you're in the hospital is to get well so you can get out. Now I decided to say to them, oh, do you have any chaplains here? I was just curious how many chaplains they had. And they said, oh, yes, we have a lot of chaplains. Would you like to talk to one? I said, no, not really, but I'm just curious. You know, do you have... I said, do you think you might have a Buddhist chaplain here? And they said, well, we have chaplains from every religion here. I said, well, that's really impressive. So let me check and see if we have a Buddhist chaplain for you. And the nurse came back an hour later and said, you know, we only have 2 chaplains, a Catholic and a Protestant. And I'm going, well, okay, I'm fine, thank you. You know, but I saw that really the whole focus was to get your body well, but all the other stuff, well, you know, you're sort of working on it yourself, or friends come to visit you and they help you, you know. So I did have people find me in the hospital. I don't know how they found me, but they did. And they brought me food. I got a chicken burrito, which was really nice. I got some chocolate, which was really nice. And people were just really friendly. And everybody was compassionate and soft voices. And it was a really interesting experience that I'd rather not go through again in the near future. And then it was time to leave. So I was talking Sunday morning, and the doctor comes in. And I said, you know, doctor, I found out how to get in here, but I'm not quite sure how to get out of here. And he says, well, that's why I'm here. And he took a look at my finger and said, oh, it's healing well, and we're going to let you go today. And so they did all the paperwork. So you just can't leave. And then they wanted to do the wheelchair thing with me. And I said, well, you know, really, it's just my finger. You know, I'm okay. And then I couldn't find the public elevator, so I used the staff elevators to get out because I just really wanted to get out. And a nurse came in and said, you know, you're not supposed to be here. I said, I know. She said, okay, I won't tell anybody. Just do the first floor and you can leave. So now I'm on Sunset Boulevard, and I'm sitting on a bench. Somebody was kind enough to come and pick me up. And I'm just watching people walk by, and I look across the street, and there's a Scientology sign in blue, just sort of glowing, and I'm thinking, wow, it's so good to just be sitting here on the street with my finger, just looking around, you know? Because now I can go home and take a nap for, like, as long as I want. Nobody's going to come and ask me how I'm doing or take blood or give me some more antibiotics. So it was quite an experience. A couple things, though, they wanted to know was, did I have a living will before I did the operation? I said, no, we haven't thought about having a living will. And they said, well, how old are you? I said, well, I'm 64. And they said, well, you might want to think about it. I said, okay. And then they said, do you have any directives you want to give us? Like if we plug you in, not to plug you in, or not to unplug you in, there's a form you can fill out for that. I said, no, I don't have any directives either. Okay, well, you might want to think about that, they told me. Then they said, would you like any member of your family to make decisions for you? And I said, no. I like my family, but we talk occasionally and stuff, but I don't know. I think I'd rather make my own decisions. So I realized that it's really important to have all this stuff sort of made out and ready before you go into the operating room. So just as I'm about to leave, they said, well, let's be cash, check, or charge. They won't let you in the operating room until it's paid for. I says, do you take checks? And then he says, thank you and good luck. And I'm going, good luck? It's a finger. So it was an experience that I'm going to integrate, and I'm going to fill out my forms, and I'm going to have them ready in case I have to go back ever again to meet my team to keep me alive or to get me well. Now, I want to tell you the second story, and this story is an insight that came to me about a couple talks I've given and a movie I just had the good fortune to watch. And I didn't want to watch this movie, don't know why, but I just enough people said, hey, you should watch this movie. So, it came out on DVD, so I watched the movie, and it was called The Life of Pi. Now, has anybody seen that movie? Okay, cool. I didn't know what to expect. And apparently what I saw in that movie is not something that everybody sees. So if you haven't seen the movie, I'm not going to ruin it for you. And if you have seen the movie, I may be able to give you some insight, at least insight into the way I saw the movie. And also how it connects to a talk I've been giving for the last couple weeks. And the talk I've been giving is Great Faith, Great Doubt, and Great Determination, which is very much a Zen attitude of practice and enlightenment. And so the first part of this is the great faith, that we hear stories. I love this idea, the concept of stories. So we've all heard stories, and that's why we're here today, of this guy who lived 2,600 years ago, who did something remarkable. He, through his own effort and volition and determination, realized his perfection as a human being. So we heard that story, and some of us may have been skeptical, and some of us may have said, well, that's really cool. Maybe I can do it. And so there's just a little bit of faith that's necessary for us to start in this path. Because this is a really difficult path to walk. It takes a lot of work. And I don't know if you feel the same way I do, but I started this path in 1979, and I'm really tired. I've been doing it for a long time with no apparent success. So I'm not quite sure, but the faith is sort of like why I started and why I'm sort of almost continuing with faith, though less and less all the time. And in the movie Pi seemed to have a religious bent, that he studied Hinduism and he studied Catholicism and he studied Islam, much to the chagrin of his dad, who was a bit more scientific, and said, this stuff is all good, and I know your mom wants you to do it that way, but science is where it's at. And so stay focused on that, and you'll have a good life. And so they were on the ship, and the ship sinks, and everybody dies. And I'm going, man, this is really a sad story. And all these people watch this, and then the animals get on the lifeboat with Pi. And I love the animals. I love the little orangutan, and I love the little zebra. I didn't like the hyena, but I wasn't supposed to like the hyena. And then the tiger was the magical part. And then they all died except for the tiger in really gruesome ways. And I'm going, wow, this movie. I wanted to feel good, and I'm watching just death and destruction on the high seas. So now it's Pi and the tiger. And his name is Richard Parker, as I recall. And so Pi didn't really trust the tiger because his dad had warned him in one of the scenes prior to this that the tiger can kill you and eat you, and you shouldn't like the tiger too much. And so they're on the lifeboat, and all of a sudden I'm watching this movie on my computer in my room at the meditation center, and something clicks. I'm going, damn. Now, I had watched a half hour of the movie, turned it off. A day later, I watched another half hour of the movie, turned it off, because it's sort of a boring movie in a way to watch 2.5 hours. But once they're in the lifeboat, I couldn't turn it off. So I invested the rest of my time in finishing this movie. What clicked for me was a book that I had read many years ago. And the book was called The Bhagavad Gita. And it's available at Amazon.com, and people have talked about it ad nauseum, and it's a wonderful book, and it's about Arjuna and Krishna And they're going off to war and to fight. And in the story of the Bhagavad Gita, there's a very important aspect of duty that Arjuna needed to learn. And his passenger in the chariot was Krishna, was God. Now, for Buddhists to get into a story about God takes a little effort and a little faith. And so I love the story. I just couldn't believe how wonderful that story is. But then they went on and killed everybody too. And I'm going, God, everybody's always killing everybody. So now I'm looking at Richard Parker, and I'm thinking to myself, Richard Parker is God. He's Krishna in this story. And he's in the lifeboat not to love Pi, not to tell Pi he's a wonderful human being. He's in the lifeboat to keep Pi alive. And one of the ways he's going to keep Pi alive is to keep him awake and clear-minded. And there's nothing better than eventual death to keep you awake and clear-minded. You know, so Richard Parker had a whole thing to do. And so now I'm looking at it through these glasses of, wow, God and Pi are in this lifeboat, and they're on the open seas, and they need survival, and wow, and there's no water, and there's no food, and blah, blah, and then they find, and then da-da-da. Okay, so it's the journey. This isn't just a tale. This is a journey. This is the journey of the hero. Okay. Now, at one moment in the movie, and you probably remember this, Richard Parker is at night looking down into the ocean, just staring at the ocean. And Pi says to him, what are you looking at? And of course, Richard Parker can't speak, so Pi decided to look down into the ocean too. And all of a sudden, he went deeper and deeper in all these creatures, and he saw this and he saw that. And it was like the cosmos sort of opened up, and we had this sort of, you know, ultimate transcendent look at the ocean, but more than that, at the universe and ourselves. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. That if Richard Parker, the tiger, is God, he had never really seen his creation through the eyes of a tiger before. So he was sort of probably pretty mesmerized, going, wow, this is really cool. Look what I did. I mean, look at all this stuff through the eyes of the tiger. You know, then they got to the island. Remember the island? And the island is the form of a human lying down. And during the day, it was a wonderful place to be. Plenty of food, and the little creatures all frolicked and had fun together. But at night, it was foreboding, and it was death-like. Oh, yeah. So Pi said, you know, we can't stay here, because if we stay here, we're just going to die. We're just going to die, because everything dies on this island. And what did the Buddha say about samsara, this planet of ours? He said, this is samsara. This is where birth and death occurs. So I'm looking at the island as being symbolic of samsara. Pi wanted more than that. And he was willing to get back into the boat with Richard Parker and go back into the ocean and not know what would happen. Whoa. And each and every one of us who started this spiritual journey knew exactly what was supposed to happen when we started. And that great faith allowed us to see with clarity the positive aspects of this path. But then after a year or 2 years or 3 years of hard work, what started to happen was doubt and skepticism. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I just can't see the good results happening. But maybe we're not supposed to see the good results. Maybe the other people in our life see the results and aren't even able to conceptualize the results or put them into any kind of paradigm or model in a way they could explain it to us. Maybe it just sort of all happens in this mysterious way, and we're just in this divine ignorance of, yeah, I'm meditating, and one day I'll be enlightened, you know. And there we are. We're meditating, and one day we'll be enlightened. And then we become doubtful that it will ever happen again. And when that happens, and it will happen to each and every one of us, it's already happened to me a couple of times. When that happens, something remarkable occurs. And that is the don't know mind. The don't know mind. Suzuki Roshi, Zen mind, beginner's mind, called the choiceless awareness. This is the time in our practice when we can make the greatest advances, when we don't know. We started with great faith. We ended up with great doubt. They canceled each other. We come to this place of, I don't know. And in that moment of, I don't know, we can become anything. We are no longer limited to what we think is going to happen or what we think should happen. We are no longer limited into what's not going to happen. We are now free to be anything we want. Wow, this is cool. But it is really scary. St. John of the Cross, Dark Night of the Soul. Man, God stopped talking to him. He didn't know. Did he do something wrong? Did God abandon him? Spiritual people have written stories about this forever, about coming to this place of abandonment, coming to this place of, I don't know if I can do it or if anybody can help me do it. And so it takes great courage. And when Pi got back into that boat and didn't know what the future held for him, that's the kind of courage we need when we come to that place in our practice of don't know. That's when our great determination is our vehicle, is our raft. That whether we know or don't know, we still get up every day and meditate. We still listen to Dharma talks. We still continue to practice. And people say, well, why do you practice? And you say, I don't know. What do you think will happen? I don't know. Why do you continue to do it? I don't know. And yet you do it. You continue to do it. And now in the movie, they make it to shore. Wow. And what does Richard Parker do? He just walks off. And didn't even turn around to say goodbye. And Pi reflected on that. You know, here we had this journey together, and he wouldn't even look at me. He just walked into the forest. Well, why did he do that, do you think? Maybe because he was God. And if it was God, God's always there anyway. He doesn't need to say goodbye because he's not going anyplace. He's just changing form again. And that's what I sort of like about the Hindu tradition, is God takes on all these different forms. You know? Now, as a Buddhist, there's nothing wrong with believing in God, but God doesn't seem to want to end our suffering, even if we do believe in God. So Buddhism sort of says, yeah, you know, God is good in a lot of different ways, but not when it comes to suffering. You got to do that yourself. And you got to have great faith, and you're going to end up with great doubt, and you're going to have the don't know mind, and you got to keep doing that because one day you'll never suffer again. Really? Well, maybe. I don't know. So now, as you recall, Pi is speaking to the two Japanese businessmen in the hospital. And they want to know why the ship went down. So Pi related the story of Richard Parker and the animals and the journey. And they said, tell us the truth. What are you making up? We need to know the truth so we can go back to our office and tell them why the ship went down. And if you recall, then Pi related another story, the story that satisfied the Japanese businessman. So why do you think that's the case? And then, as you recall, at the very end of the movie, the author who's been listening to both stories asked Pi, well, which story is true? But Pi said, well, which story do you like the best? Because actually, all stories are true. And the author said, oh, I like the animal one the best. And Pi smiled. So here we are, and we've been meditating, and we've been listening to stories, and there's the Buddha, and if you're into Mahayana Buddhism, they're the Bodhisattvas, and different realms of existence, you know? And then you go and you talk to close friends and family members about all the stories that you've been listening and think are really cool, and you start to relate to them. And you share your stories, and they turn away, and they think you've joined a cult, and you'll never be normal again. And then you do just what Pi did to the Japanese businessmen. You just break it down to secular reality. Yeah, I sat for a long time. My knees really hurt. And your family goes, yeah, of course. Why do you sit? I don't know. Okay. They feel comfortable with that because that's their reality. We're creating another reality for ourselves that may not be shareable. We may not be able to share our reality unless we're with members of the Sangha who are creating the same stories, who are having those stories created for them in the beginning by teachers and books and retreats, but ultimately creating your own story. And that's what sort of what the Buddha wanted us to do, I think, is he said, you know, I'm just a teacher, so I'm going to teach you how I made my story. And then I'm going to encourage you to make your story. And each one of us, because we've had many lifetimes and have our own distinct and separate karma, are going to have our own story. And there may be similarities, and they may be connected to the stories of others, but it'll still be our story. And that's why I'm a little hesitant about someone who wants to save me or tell me what I should do or shouldn't do. I'm willing to listen to advice and opinions, but I would like to have the final say. And I need to take personal responsibility for my choices and decisions. Nobody else can do that for me. Wow, okay. So now, do we use the secular story or do we use the spiritual story? Are they both true at some level? Is one relative? Is one ultimate? Is one transcendent? Is one based in science and reality? Which one do you want? Which is the better story for you? As Pi might say to us at the end of the movie, what story do you like the best? So you can tell that I had a real ride in watching The Life of Pi, that I just was just into this whole other story thing going on. And I'm just going, man, this is so cool. And I just wanted to share it with everybody who watched The Life of Pi. And I started to speak and they would go, what? What? God was Richard Parker? Really? Why did I miss that? They would say to me. Obvious to me. So now I don't share quite as much anymore. Now, I just now it's just a wonderful movie that stimulated me in a very special way and allowed me to see things in a way that I hadn't seen them before for a very long time. And I can recommend the Bhagavad Gita if you haven't read it yet, and Eknath Ishwaran. Now I'm probably just messing up his name. Eknath Ishwaran has a really nice version of the Bhagavad Gita, as well as the Dhammapada. And those are, he is an author that I would recommend, and those are two really nice books with a verse and a commentary, and a verse and a commentary. So it's a very pleasant way to learn and understand those two important texts. Now, I would like to open this up for maybe discussion or questions or comments on what I've just said. Am I really like off the mark? Am I on the mark? Yes, sir.
So when you talk about like what kind of story you prefer, I'm kind of a cheater in like how it comes to meditation, because like with this great faith component, the blossoming world of like proof and research around like the link between like neurological benefit and meditation that's coming out, that's what drew me in. And like seeing how like
proof that it works.
Yeah. So like, I'm just like impressed by it, but also like daunted by it myself. But it's so nice to be able to send someone who's like, what are you doing when you meditate? Forward them a New York Times article about like, you know, like this beautiful world of research is happening. That works for me. You know, like, I love a good mirror.
Well, I think one of the things that you bring up is really important, that we needed to change the dialogue about meditation in order to get it into the institutions. So you go to UCLA, you can find mindfulness meditation. You go into the Army, you can find mindfulness meditation. It's being allowed into various institutions because it is not spiritual, it is secular, and it's been scientifically proven that it does alter your consciousness in a good and wholesome way. But there are a lot of people who would look at that and go, so, you know, I want to go to heaven. How do I do that in meditation? Or I want to be a better person spiritually. Will meditation help me do that? So we have these two different stories, like the Japanese businessman and then the story that Pi related to the author about the tigers and all the mystical, schmystical stuff that a lot of us in 2013 would go and say, oh man, this is just fables. These are just metaphors. You know, this stuff is not real. The real stuff is in the MRI because I can see it, it's proven, it's scientifically acceptable. Depends where you're coming from. I think it works on both levels, scientifically, which is becoming more and more accepted now, and spiritually, which is how it started in the first place. And so whatever got you in and keeps you there is a good thing, because you'll only benefit from it. Yeah, that's cool. So do you still have your MRI?
No, I totally didn't. I don't actually have an MRI. I love
it. Okay, it would be cool to... Yes. Well, one is very satisfying to the mind, and one is very satisfying to the heart with feelings. And sometimes if we try to turn those feelings into intellectual models, we fail miserably. That's why we keep using the word love over and over again to describe 10,000 different things, you know. So the Buddhist path would be the path of wisdom, clarity, the MRI, and the path of compassion, heart, feeling. So you're right. So two different levels, they work together. We, as a culture, I think, have lost the ability to see the magic in the world. Now, you go to places like India, the magic still exists. Stuff is alive, you know? And you go to some of these indigenous... something about the Mayans I was watching. And it's just, man, it's still alive. That, you know, the trees and the mountains and they... have shape and form, and they have, it's something. And you come to L.A., and it's like dead, you know? And not in a bad way, but just in a very secular, intellectual way, you know? We have these really cool old houses, and we just like tear them down to build a new house that looks better, theoretically. And so it's, in a way, what meditation can do for you is awaken the magic in your life again. That has been put to sleep because of years of education and the MRIs. You know, so it's cool to have it's cool to have magic too. Yeah.
Can I ask a slightly off topic question?
Of course.
Sometimes I find that when I'm meditating, I kind of cross through some kind of, like, I thread the needle just the right way by allowing and relaxing, where I can feel, I guess, energy or something, like, be very full. And then I feel like I'm being pushed against, like, a membrane. There's something, and if only I could just allow myself past that, I don't know what, but something would, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
There's something, I don't know what it is. So it's kind of a two-part question. If you have any clue what that's about, that would be really helpful. And then also... I feel like, and I can elaborate if you need to, and then I feel like my meditation is very brain-centered. Like, it's all about getting my brain to, like, calm down, but it's not about my heart at all. And I think that that's an issue, but I don't know how to address it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, good. The first thing is we in our meditation practice, we all experience altered states of consciousness. And it's just part of what happens. And there are some places we come to where we say, perhaps to ourselves, if only I could just, and then I would experience it completely. And the problem with that is that the I can't do that. The I limits you in your experience.
I feel like I'd have to let that go to get past that.
Yes, and the I can't let the I go.
Right.
It's just, we're sort of stuck, you know. So what I have found in a workaround is to create conditions necessary for it to happen. Mm-hmm. Not to say, I'm going to make it happen, but what conditions do I need to create for it to happen? Now, I know, what do I mean by that? I know, it's like a koan. It means that, for instance, what conditions do I need to create for the laundry to be done? Okay, I need to have quarters, and I need to have laundry soap, and then I need to get somebody to put the clothes into the washer. Okay, so if I create enough of those conditions, washing will occur, and I'll have clean clothes.
I think I understand what you mean now.
Okay, so nothing ever happens because of one thing. It's always many things coming together in a specific combination that allows it to happen. Word of warning, though, it can only happen once. Everything in our life only happens once. So if you get enough conditions for it to happen, you'll never get the same conditions again for it to happen in the same way. Nothing ever happens the same way twice. And we don't either, which is why we have impermanence and concentrated flux. Some of the things seem similar. It seems like we've experienced them before, but there is something different about them each time. So don't get too caught up in finding the right conditions, because it only works once. And then you have to find more conditions, other conditions for it to happen again.
And then you're back in samsara anyway.
You're back in samsara.
Yeah.
And so the idea is to sort of just sit and practice and experience and then go have a cup of coffee. And life is just the way it's supposed to be.
I understand.
And then one day you'll be enlightened and may not even know it.
That makes sense.
Now, the second part was...
Well,
heart and mind.
Mind versus heart,
Well, mindfulness meditation is very focused on the mind. Needless to say, there's four kinds of mindfulness meditation: body, sensations, mind, mental objects. But it's an analytical way. It's an analytical approach to release, to moksha, to liberation, to nirvana. There's another kind of meditation called samatha meditation, samadhi meditation, which is tranquility meditation, which the Buddha did as well, which has a lot to do with heart and feelings and opening up that way. And one of the best practices that I have found is the loving kindness meditation, which I'll do at the end today. And just to recite that over and over and over again: may I be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to me. May no difficulties come to me. I'll do the whole thing at the end. We just say the words. We don't think about the words. We don't envision the words. We don't try to understand what they all mean together. We just say the words over and over and over again. And all of a sudden, your heart starts to open. Now, another word of warning about this practice is when your heart does open, you cry a lot. And for a guy, at least a guy from my era, to stand on stage and give a Dharma talk and start crying, rather embarrassing. Because I don't know why I'm crying. All of a sudden I have this feeling that arises. And what that means to me is that at some point in my practice, my heart broke. And it never mended. And never can mend again. So there's always this sensitivity that I ignored before Buddhism and meditation practice that now has become a standard in my life. And it, I go to a movie and I'm watching the movie and all of a sudden I start crying. Now, I've been told that older men cry. After a certain age, men cry more. But maybe their hearts have been broken so many times, you know. And so I could never go see Bambi again, because I would just be, you know, to the whole movie, where's the Kleenex, you know? And odd things make me cry. I don't know what they are. Now, the cat bite didn't make me cry. It made me sort of wonder why. You know? But so as we break our heart and as we open our mind, we start to experience life in a really unique way that other people may not understand and we may not be able to understand either initially. But it's part of the spiritual journey, the journey of the hero to fully manifest and fully feel and think everything, you know. But thinking has its own special place and feeling has its own special place and they balance each other out. So I tell people, if you have too much compassion and no wisdom, you're going to give all your money away and starve. If you have too much wisdom and no compassion, you won't give any money away. So we want to give enough money away. And in order to do that, we need to have wisdom and compassion. So loving kindness meditation is a great place to start.
Thank you.
And don't blame me for the crying. You know. Yes. I've got the book, too.
I didn't see the movie, but I read the book years ago. The not knowing, and being in the I don't know, that was perfect for today, because I'm experiencing that. I mean, I've been meditating a long time. I've been experiencing that in meditation and in my life, and those two things don't really, I mean, it's one thing isn't necessarily exclusive of another. It's funny, I was having a business lunch the other day, and I was saying, oh, tell me about Jerry. It's like, whenever anybody asks, it's like, what am I supposed to say that? But I said that I'm a meditator. He goes, oh, does that mean that you get, does that mean you're peaceful and calm all the time? And I said, I don't know. He said, well, what does meditation do for you? I said, well, I don't know. You know, you have to do it. You know, and people don't, you know, a lot of people don't really because they don't want to really have to do it. They just want to know.
They want to know. And that's why you, like this fellow over here, you say, oh, well, they have, you know, statistics and MRIs and books written about the benefits of meditation. But personally, I don't know.
Well, and what I was going to say is that was what I've been thinking about in this, you know, whole talk bringing up more for me is we seem to, it's like you have to name it. Human beings seem to have to name everything.
Mm-hmm.
And something they have to know, because it's like this control thing. And if we don't know, like you said, then who are we? What are we? What are we doing?
Well, if we don't know, it doesn't exist.
Right.
Which is fascinating to me. That if it's only in the naming of it that we bring it into existence. So we pull it out of the fabric of the cosmos and make it stand independently. So it's, and we're the only animals that can really do that. We have such a wonderful language that allows us to be somebody.
Well, what I'm seeing more and more is that the naming, especially for meditation, not only really doesn't mean anything, but it's just a very limited. They can be very limited.
Absolutely. But for the but for the 7 billion other people, it really it means something. So we can be mystical and speak in poetry if we want to, you know, and not name anything and not give anything life, you know. But it makes other people feel uncomfortable. So we sort of need to dance between the two perspectives of not knowing, which is perhaps the true reality that we're headed towards, and then the relative reality of having to know as much as we can, so we can interact in a social way with other humans and seem normal.
Well, and how do you answer that question when somebody says, why do you meditate?
Yeah. Well, I would start with, if they're younger, if they're under 30, I meditate to feel good. I want to be happy. And if they're over 30, yesterday I was at Leisure World giving a talk, I meditate so I don't suffer. And it's as simple as that. Now, it's a great lead-in if you want to be an evangelical Buddhist, you know, to say, I meditate so I don't suffer. And then they go, really? Well, how do you do it? And then you've got a whole hour and a half of just, you know, monologue available to you. But I would say we really need to keep it simple, and we need to keep it understandable as well. that if we get too far out, either scientifically or spiritually, we'll lose them forever. I want to be happy. I have too much stress in my life. I've been told meditation helps me reduce stress. And that little simple answer should be enough to satisfy most people. If somebody's really interested, you know, then you need to have a vocabulary to use. You know, and it could be a Buddhist vocabulary, it could be a scientific vocabulary, a psychiatric vocabulary, something that allows them to go a little bit deeper. You know, but to find somebody that's using the same words with the same meaning is really rare, because we all use a lot of the same words, but they all mean something different to us. So isn't it amazing that human communication works as well as it does? You know, because the odds are against us for ever understanding each other. And maybe we don't, maybe we just think we do, and that's good enough, you know. So I would say keep it simple, keep it short, and go on to the next subject. Yes?
Your stories remind me of Suzuki Roshi and his way of meeting people where they are.
Yes.
And which reminds me of a story of one of my Dharma friends who lived at the San Francisco Zen Center at the time of Suzuki Roshi. And he had come from New York, and his parents were in the luncheonette business. And he was like, so what, you couldn't be a rabbi? And, you know, how do you explain this Zen thing and meditation and Buddhism? And so finally they came to the San Francisco Zen Center, and they see, and my friend sees his father talking to Suzuki Roshi with his glass doors, and they're like animated and having a good time, and he's thinking, aha, finally, Suzuki Roshi is going to explain Zen Buddhism and has done it to my father. So he comes out and he asks his father, so, you know what? What were you talking to the Roshi about? And he goes, oh, what? Roshi? We were talking about the luncheonette business.
There we go.
So I just wanted to share that you inspired me to remember meeting the situation, you know, where it is.
Where the person is, yeah. And we need to honor that. And generally speaking, we can't take them beyond that.
And it's also an opening, because from that place, you create suppleness and curiosity, and then maybe you can have a conversation about meditation, if that's what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. At whatever level they want to have it as. Creating the mystery again, which is something interesting, you know, that one moment in between the two spaces where you don't have a word for it, and that's a chance to think in a different way. And so Zen is very big at poetry and symbolism to get you that place of don't know, so you have an opportunity to learn something else, or learn nothing at all. And in our conversations with people, if we're skillful and lucky, we can perhaps inspire them to pick up a book or go to a Zendo or come to Against the Stream one time, you know, to just see what it's all about. And then it's up to them after that. And parents are impossible to talk to. My father was a Lutheran and knew I was going to hell. And my mother was non-religious and always the religion of her father or of her husband. And she said, as long as I was happy, she was happy, which I think is something that's really nice about moms, you know. And so she would send me articles about the Dalai Lama when she found him in the local newspaper. And so, I mean, she didn't read them, but she would send them to me. So I thought that was very nice of her to do that. But she didn't need to know about Buddhism. She just needed to know her son was better than he would have been without Buddhism. Yeah, yeah, So it's, for me, it's difficult to say enough and not too much, because I enjoy talking. Yeah, well, it could be a gift, looked at in the correct way, you know. But thank you. Anybody else have anything? Yes. Oh, please. Hi.
Hi. I have so many things I could ask. Mm-hmm. And it was after a very, very traumatic life event. Where I'm at sometimes is, I'm like, wow, this. I feel like I've learned so much. The transformation has been so dramatic that a year ago, 9 months ago, I was in a psychiatric hospital.
There we go.
And through all, it basically took me into the path of Buddhism, and it was kind of mysterious how that happened. But I'll think to myself, wait a minute, you're really not suffering. And I go through the entire spectrum of emotions and experiences and insecurities and everything. A friend of mine recently died, a close friend, just a couple of weeks ago. And when he was passing, mm-hmm. at that moment, I was feeling like, well, I'm a Buddhist. And death is just, beautiful thing. This is, and I'm going to be fine, and I'm going to help him. And then when he passed, it was like, ha ha, no. You will go through the grief and the pain, and so much pain.
You will be human.
You will be human.
Oh. Yeah.
But where sometimes I get at is going like, maybe that's the doubt we're talking about, thinking like, am I delusional because I'm not feeling like I'm suffering,
mm-hmm.
even though things happen and emotions happen, but I always am able to come back to that mindfulness and go, okay, look at this.
Mm-hmm.
Your old friend is.
Can you define suffering for me?
Can I find suffering?
Can you define suffering for me?
The fight against what's happening.
Okay.
Whatever's happening to me in my mind and my heart can be very uncomfortable and feel bad in a moment, and then kind of stepping back and being mindful of what is happening, mm-hmm. sitting with it. That's the big change. The pain that I went through this past summer was instrumental because I experienced it in every drop of it, and that took me to a very different place. So I always remember that, and no matter if it's a day, a week, an hour that I'm going, the stepping back and the also letting it happen and watching it has made it so that I'll be going through pain, discomfort, and whatever, but there's always a point where I let the clinging aversion go. And so that's why I honestly, I don't know if I'm just delusional and the wool's going to be pulled out and I'm going to see that.
Yeah, unfortunately, you'll probably never know. And one day the world will be pulled out, and there you go. But that's the idea in this practice, is to experience everything completely. We don't want to be indifferent. That's for sure. That's not good. Equanimity is good, mm-hmm. being able to accept things the way they are.
But that's what I feel.
Well, it's good to think of it that way, because it may be temporary.
Right.
And then the next week, back to the hell realm.
Right.
And you go, what happened? And you go, well, I guess I just have to keep practicing, because I'm not there yet. So they say enlightenment, we have various times in our life when we experience enlightenment and we have deep insight. And generally speaking, though, it goes away after a while. They say nirvana doesn't go away when you've achieved nirvana, that you will always be in that place of equanimity and balance and happiness and non-suffering. We don't know what that place is or when we're going to get there. So I would say that you're doing exactly what you need to do, is you're observing it, you're analyzing it, you're being self-reflective. You see less suffering in your life, so the practice is working. It may not have ended, so we shouldn't be surprised if we continue to suffer in the future. And the persistence and determination we have with that practice will eventually take us to the other shore. They're fond of saying taking the raft to the other shore. So I wouldn't put too much value or emphasis on it. I would just keep doing what you're doing, and it's nice to suffer less for a while.
Yeah.
And then the cat bites you, and you go, okay, well, another way to suffer. Or another way to feel pain. So pain is not optional, but suffering is. And you sounds like you've made good progress so far. I hope it continues. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's about time for us to go and continue our day. I'd like to do a loving kindness meditation to end it. And they're having a big concert downtown today. Did you know that? They closed down the streets, and people are going to be playing musical instruments, and I'm not sure who's there or why, but just something for us to do on a Sunday afternoon, or not do. May those of us who have come together today, in mind and heart, be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to us. May no difficulties come to us. May no problems come to us. May we always find fulfillment. May we also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May our parents, our partners, our pets, our brothers and sisters, friends and family, all the people we don't know, all the people we don't like, may they too be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always find fulfillment. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. From the highest realm of existence to the lowest, may all beings arisen in any of these realms, with form and without, with perception and without, with consciousness and without, may they too be happy, peaceful, and free from suffering. May no harm come to them. May no difficulties come to them. May no problems come to them. May they always find fulfillment. May they also have patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome the inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May the suffering ones be suffering free, the fear-struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief. May the sick find health relief.